I'm Stargate Pioneer from the Starling Tribune, a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Camille Kajiri, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. And so you should. Keep your finger on the button and don't stop listening, because there's nothing better anywhere else.
Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
Did you just say womp womp?
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Episode 169 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where the fact that it strikes us as unusual that 51% of the population are now gaining prominence on camera and behind it is essentially the most obvious sign of the original problem. Huh? So, are things actually improving, or are we only being made more aware of the work yet to be done? In the GPR studios, my name is Keir, and along with me in the studios, as always, is my co-host Haley. Haley, how you doing tonight?
I am doing fantastic.
Excellent. Jay is AWOL this evening. He's tending some business, but filling his seat with reckless abandon is our guest, Alyssa Frank of Whovian Feminism.
Hey there.
Howdy.
This is exciting.
Excellent. We will try to keep the excitement levels at a near fever pitch.
Awesome.
Haley, what's up tonight?
Well, this week, we're going to sit amid the settling dust, debris, and spent tissues that mark the beautiful chaos of Series 9, and realize that this may be the closest we have yet come to the Whovian Year of the Woman. And that includes both the classic 1963 to 1989 run, and the post-2005 New Who revival. And, you know, that movie, somewhere in the middle.
Hey.
Hey.
We give Matthew Jacobs all the love in the world. He is a friend of the podcast, and we look forward to his documentary, Doctor Who Am I? Well, the discussion for tonight is a pretty interesting one, and it's of particular prominence because of the power of everything that we were handed in Series 9. We've been discussing at regular intervals and at length all of the various accusations, commentary, discussions, condemnations, and everything else involving chauvinism and misogyny in the Doctor Who realm, and all of its ebbs and flows from 1963 onwards. So who better to join us for the discussion than Alyssa of Whovian Feminism? And I figure we should begin as near the beginning as we can. First things first, but not necessarily in that order, as the Doctor would say. So, Alyssa, before we get into the nitty-gritty here, just a kind of a general take from you about where things stand in the series at present. Are we in good standing right now? Are we on a steady improvement, or is this, as far as you would describe it, just part of a process that has to continue?
I would say that we are in better standing than we have been for quite some time. There are a lot of great women who are now behind the scenes as writers and directors. I think that we have had some absolutely amazing women join the cast in the last year, and we've seen some female characters have absolutely incredible journeys. And I think that it is a process that will have to continue. There is no declaring victory and suddenly we're done. Yay, it's all good and sexism is over and feminism can just go sit on a shelf and be happy with itself. I think that we are better than we've been in the entire show's history when it comes to representation behind the camera, but we are nowhere near equality. And I think that we have done, that we have seen some incredible stories in Doctor Who lately, but that I'm always looking for the next story and looking to see where our female characters will go next.
Mm, yeah. Haley, your thoughts on this right now?
I think especially, I don't have a lot of classic Who exposure, but especially since the revival of Who, it seems like on the front end, they've done a pretty good job of having good female representation, but it's a problem industry-wide that representation behind the camera, writers, producers, directors, that kind of thing, women are very much underrepresented. And I think it's starting to improve, but there's always more room for improvement.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and that's definitely something that I want to make sure that we reference in tonight's discussion, is to make sure that we are including the aspect of outside of the Doctor Who scope. You know, the fact that there may be finally some sort of an industry supported or just general cultural support behind really shoving the entire initiative forward. And we'll get to things like the current, you know, hot topics of discussion like Jessica Jones and some of the major changes in the latest Star Wars cinematic release and things like that. Woohoo! But we'll try to contain ourselves. But all right, so going back to some of our groundwork here, obviously one of the things that we can always rest a bit of a laurel on is the fact that one of our initial producers and one of the driving forces behind getting the program on the air in the first place was Verity Lambert. Then there was this long lapse through the 60s, through the 70s, and onward, where at least from a producer's standpoint, you know, some of the people who were making some of the strongest executive decisions, it wasn't until, I want to say, well into New Who, like 2007 or so, that we ended up with Susie Liggett, who was actually in there just because she was assisting. She was there to assist Phil Collins, and at the time, who had taken the executive production helm with RTD from the revival point. So as far as your estimation, and either one of you, feel free to jump in on this, what do you think might have been some sort of a contributing factor to that locked door for decades, and what kind of impact it might have had on some of the more on-screen or in-the-script representations in the show?
I really just think for the time period, Verity was the anomaly, and the lack of women behind the scenes was kind of the standard through the 60s, the 70s, even into the 80s.
Mm. Yeah, there were very few women who were working in those fields. And there's also just sort of this general attitude that frankly persists today, that science fiction and those sort of genre shows are really men's fields, and women get pushed out a lot or not given the recognition they deserve, or just simply aren't invited to participate on those shows. Nobody reaches out to them and says, this seems like something you may like. You know, do you want to write an episode here, direct an episode there, you know, come on and produce this show? Women sort of get pushed into other types of television. So it's, I think, taken some women to break some boundaries and really say, no, we deserve to be here as well. We're just as interested in this.
Mm, okay. And I think I absolutely agree that it wasn't just a matter of some of the decision makers, but it also had this trickle-down effect in terms of the content that was being created as well. Because if you were to try to look to women writers for the program, there was this strange history of women who were credited at one point but didn't actually create any content, or it was actually a woman's name being used as a pseudonym for certain episodes, and it's just a very, very odd origin story. And as far as any possibility that they were going to bring content to the table that helped that representative role, I have to imagine that it was horrendously damaged, even until you got up into things like the Baker couple, you know, for Pip and, oh, help me here, Pip and Jane Baker, writing for the Sixth and Seventh Doctors. So, I mean, at that point, and I still don't, maybe I'll have to continue to do a little bit of research. I don't really know what the balance of creative control was between the two of them when they co-wrote. Alyssa, do you happen to know anything more about their backstory?
I don't happen to know anything off the top of my head about their backstory now.
Okay, well, it's just a matter of, you know, at that point, you have to wonder whether or not it was a matter of placating. I know they do say when they hold up the nature of the content that was created, and we're going to be talking quite a bit about the Bechdel test because it's one of those things that just people continue to bring up until we have something more definitive that we can utilize. Maybe it's one of the, at least the most socially acceptable reference points. But as far as content created, you can actually call the Sylvester McCoy era as one of the most successful, or if not the most successful, classic Who era, as far as giving a better stance to women cast members, and in terms of the character content that's created. But even then, you know, you hold that against the giant, against a larger scale, and it still had plenty of work to do. So then we step forward, you know, we go through our dark years, the, you know, the 96 pilot being what it is. I don't know, do we want to even put that, you know, just pin that to the wall and say, yep, that's a thing, and we'll move on? Or is, okay. Or is there actually anything that you want to be able to take out of that? Because, I mean, this, if anything, it may have been a potentially a step backward.
It's just kind of an odd story structure anyways. Mm. There's only one female character in there.
And so. She is immediately thrust into romantic interest with the Doctor to a degree that none else for some time had been able to attain, nor in many estimations should they have been able to attain. Okay, so we'll move on from that. But then we get to our restart point in 2005 and into the Russell T. Davies era, and there, as we mentioned, as far as executive production staff, as far as some writing staff, as far as some representation from a directorial standpoint, we see some opportunity creeping back in. Where does this fall on the acceptability scale, though, as far as what we would want to see when we're climbing back up from the bottom of the barrel, as it were?
I think that you have a really interesting focus on women and their stories. When you start off with the revival of the show in 2005. But to tie this slightly back into your discussion of 1963 to 1989, the classic series, I think that we should give credit where it's due in that there were a lot of periods of time in which men were primarily the writers and directors, and there weren't a lot of women, but you could have very good representation of women on screen and a variety of roles for them to play. And it mostly required being intentional about who was on screen and what they were talking about and showing their inner lives and stories. And I think that Ace from Sylvester McCoy's era was a really good example of this. She had another woman who almost served as her companion in nearly every single story that she was in. And I think that you start seeing, and this is not necessarily a perfect test, but it's a very good reference point to point to. You see very high Bechdel test scores in some of the early New Who seasons because you have Rose, and then you have Rose's mother, and then you have these other female characters that are being created in these stories for her to talk to sort of examine their lives and be able to get an insight into their story from their perspective. So it just really requires being intentional about how you think about it and how you create roles for women in the show.
Mm. Do you think we had at least... I know we have, as far as her representation, as far as her contributions to the program, I'm thinking back specifically of Tegan as well. But she was not given as much of an opportunity to carry that kind of on-screen gravity. She certainly had the capability, certainly had the desire to, but was sort of boxed in a bit to be the mouth on legs, as she likes to refer to herself. And she's come to not only accept that, but to wield that as a weapon to this day. It's fantastic. But I'm also wondering, what about individuals, female roles who were carried to be an intellectual equal with the Doctor? I'm thinking of Romana too and characters of that sort. She had the possibility, since she was an intellectual equal with the Doctor, and in many instances was actually the one to point out the solution paths and to be sort of that catalyst for the for dealing with the situation at hand. She never was able to fully realize, or was given the opportunity to fully realize the character as a true feminist representation. I mean, we were dealing with, you know, early to mid 70s at this point, so it was, she was still, you know, the schoolgirl uniform, the matter of being, you know, having to use her her guile rather than her intellect when dealing with anyone else but the Doctor in many situations. So do you have any theories as to whether that was something that they were attempting to experiment with and then scaled back on, or whether it was never really the intent from the get-go?
I don't personally have any theories. I think that it sort of comes from how we imagine the roles and how we put women into boxes with those roles. I think that Romana has a lot of great moments where she gets to be sort of an intellectual force that is equal to, and in many cases superior to, the Doctor. But that if people tend to fall back on easy archetypes and easy stereotypes when they're writing an episode, and so sometimes it gets a little bit more into the guile and it becomes a little bit more of, is she carrying the plot or is she an instigator for other plot moments to happen? So I think that it's really, it's a matter of, are we being intentional about how we're using this character? And are we falling back onto sort of easier archetypes?
Okay. Well, I'm glad that you bring that up, because as we start to move into, you know, post-2005, we start getting into the RTD period and some of the decisions made. You know, as you mentioned, there are opportunities that are presented for characters like Rose to be able to have standout moments. And, you know, the fact that they actually just, they strike us as standout moments is a problem in and of itself. But those opportunities do still exist. Then we end up, and I'm going to look a little farther down the road and say representations like Donna Noble and everything that she was able to, you know, to break loose with. But in between, we've got what I'm only going to refer to as the Martha backslide. And a lot of people are divided on whether or not the character even has merit because of the fact that she started out in one stance and was eroded to a certain degree in a lot of the discussions and critiques that I've seen into something that rendered her, well, a lot more inert as far as a feminist representation. Do you have thoughts on this?
I will always defend Martha. She is the character of the hill that I will die on. I think that Martha is a very complicated character, because if we consider her arc on its own, I think that it's actually incredibly powerful about thinking about how we want to establish boundaries for ourselves and how we sort of come to terms with our relationships with other people and how we learn to stand up for ourselves and not define ourselves by how people consider us. And I think that Martha is a very interesting story of sort of falling in and out of love, and the complicated negotiations that come with that. You know, if she's pretty much in love with the Doctor this entire time, and, you know, she is sort of feeling her own self-worth erode because she knows he's still in love with Rose, and she's sort of comparing herself to Rose, and she sort of comes out of her arc saying, you know what, I am good, and she doesn't need to compare herself to anyone else. She doesn't need to define her own worth and value by whether or not the Doctor is ever going to love her back. And Martha, I think, is one of those characters that's really interesting in the gaps. She leaves at the end of her arc, and then she comes back briefly during Donna's tenure, and she's you know, working at UNIT. She is becoming a sort of an expert and an authority on Earth, on aliens in her own right, and making her own decisions, her own judgments. And then we go again to the end of series four, and she's sort of freelancing. Like, there's a really interesting arc there. I think that where Martha becomes complicated is in the context. So we've had the Doctor come back and be in love with Rose for basically every series that had come before that, whether it was explicit or not. And, you know, I think that we as viewers were sort of ready for something different, and we were ready to see a new sort of companion relationship, or new for the time, certainly wasn't new for Classic Who. And I think that it's sort of off-putting to constantly be reminded of Rose is gone and Martha's not as good. Rose is gone and Martha's not as good. Like, that's hard to watch. So, you know, I will always defend her. I think that she's a really fascinating character, but even I can't deny the first time I watched her arc, I was just incredibly annoyed the entire time because I wanted to be moving on. I wanted to be focusing on something other than a companion falling in love with the Doctor again.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I love everything about her character except for her crush on the Doctor that won't go away, that they keep bringing up every single episode. And I really wish they'd done a second episode where she'd moved past, or a second series with her, where she'd moved past that and she was just the Doctor's companion and they were off having cool adventures, because she's an interesting companion.
Yeah.
It's just she got bogged down in the crush thing that they had to keep doing.
Mm. Okay. Well, that's, and that's a bit of a criticism that RTD had taken at regular intervals, in the fact that when there was no clear path for his B story arcs and things of that sort, that he would defer to falling back on some of these quick, very sidelining tropes, because it was quick viewership, it was quick fan base acceptability to say, well, we're gonna sprinkle a little bit of love and magic dust here for a moment to sort of keep the second plot line moving through on this two episode arc or what have you, and we'll get back to some of the more complicated emotional upheavals at a later point when I've got a clear path in front of me. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I've heard it often enough. I'm not going to jump up on an anti RTD soapbox as many people do, because they'll scream about, well, whatever, Slytherin or whatever it is that they want to rail about at the time. But I think as far as queuing up some of the scrutiny that his successor takes on, that's where it really starts getting interesting, and obviously the discussions start getting much, much more heated. So Moffat steps into the role, and the accusations of misogyny come flying out of the woodwork within about a season. In about a season, right. Yeah, as soon as we really start getting to know Amy Pond very well. So where did the wheels come off the wagon?
Oh, boy.
This should have been an episode in and of itself, but it's not.
I will prepare myself for the hate mail. I think that for a lot of people, Amy's first appearance is very off-putting, not just because she's written into the role of the Kissogram, but in the way that she's portrayed. So you have that first scene where the Doctor is seeing her as an adult, and the way you're introduced to her as an adult is that long shot up her legs in her skimpy costume, finally getting to her face. Like, you've never had a clear example of the male gaze. We are not just seeing her as the Doctor sees her, we are seeing a very objectifying portrayal of her. And I mean, it's one of the most explicit examples of the male gaze I can find. If I taught a film class, I would be using that all the time. And I think that that's a little bit off-putting for people to see it. I didn't actually start getting fairly intense about this until the mystical pregnancy trope plot line that we had the next season, where she's pregnant and not pregnant and then suddenly very, very pregnant and giving birth, and then her baby turns to jello and vanishes in her arms. I am very much not a fan of that storyline, or particularly any use of that trope. It strikes me as being a very sort of dehumanizing kind of trope, and I don't think that they really dealt well with what the fallout of that would be, especially because so much of the fallout focused on how Amy felt she was failing Rory as a wife, and there wasn't really a lot of work done to counter that perception in the show. Mm. I mean, I could bring up grievance after grievance that I've had. I think that the show in total is not misogynist. I don't think that Moffat himself is this explicit, like, running around constantly trying to be misogynist. I just think that there are moments where the desire to do something fun or interesting or sexy sort of takes away from that moment, like makes it sort of just explicitly kind of terrible for some women to be watching. So moments like that just really bother me.
Well, that's, I'm glad you brought that up as far as rehashing a lot of these tropes that end up becoming just objectifying in and of themselves, because we're not done with them. I mean, they're continuing to persist. I don't know necessarily whether they're abating at all or whether they're just being countered by a greater number of counter utilizations, more effective utilizations of characters of all genders, so that it almost serves as an example of, okay, you can go ahead and continue to make television the way you guys choose to. And I say guys, meaning exactly what I'm saying when I'm saying guys. But you choose to make the programming that you do, we're going to open the public's eyes to examples that you can have effective science fiction. Hey, remember, this is a science fiction program here that doesn't always have to be mired in emotional hang-ups and relationships. Such, you can have that there if you want to humanize your characters or draw that element into it. But at its core, remember what the program is about, and you can do it effectively, and you can do it in a sense where it does not matter. It's not even just a matter of gender equality, it's gender neutrality. And maybe that's another discussion for another time.
Mm-hmm. It's a very big discussion.
But hey, sounds like something we should bring up at a con. But it tees us up into, well, we got some hints of it in Series 8, and then Series 9 looks like somebody suddenly realized what should or could be going on.
It's like Moffat got a peek at my wish list. It's amazing.
Haley, do you remember when we started off the season, we were talking about things that, all the criticisms that Moffat's been getting, and we defended him as much as we could. We put on as many layers of armor and heavy coats as we could. And as we started going through Series 9, we're like, okay, he crossed that off the list. Okay. It's like he was listening
to
all of
us.
He
read the internet.
Yeah. And then he backpedaled on a few things, and we gave him a pass.
Oh, yeah.
But all right, so here we are in Series 9, and I'm going to jump right off into the deep end, since this is our point of discussion, and that has to do with some of the themes and the representation and the tropes that get played or dismissed. How did we do?
Amazing.
I love, 97% of the things that happened in Series 9.
Yeah, I think I'm probably about the same. Most of it, I think, was absolutely stellar. And any, moments that I have that I have qualms with are really, in the end, kind of small qualms,
Okay. One of the major things that drew near and dear to our hearts over the course of this past series is the nature of the storytelling. You may attribute a certain degree of it to them really paying conscious attention to the strength of the two-parter. And again, another topic for another time, about whether or not the story really needs to have all the breathing room that it requires to be told in full. But in doing so, it almost seems as though there was a cohesiveness to the series, a path that was... It wasn't necessarily lacking in series prior, but it was so much more agreed upon through all creative parties involved, and that reflected down to the individual performances, because they had a consistent character that they were working with a consistent directive, and I hope I'm making sense with this here. So what do you think might have occurred? I mean, we joke about the fact that, he finally logged into Tumblr and So, you know, because he knows that Tumblr is a place where he's crucified on a daily basis. But joking aside, what do you think might have possibly happened that has accounted for such a dramatic shift?
You know, I think that part of it is it definitely seems like there were criticisms that were made that he paid attention to that were addressed. But I think that the thing that really helped, you talk about focus on the storytelling and the characters. I think he really bought into the Clara Who arc. I think that there was a lot of discussion about how the show was turning into a bit of Clara Who. And I don't know, it almost seems like he looked at that and went, okay, I'll turn it 100% into Clara Who, and we're going to see what happens with it. And I think that that really helped, because if you sort of tilt your head, squint your eyes, Series 9 can really be seen as the origin story of Clara as her own doctor. And we have a big focus on the doctor and his story with the hybrid arc and learning to cope with endings and dealing with your responsibilities. But we also have this parallel arc of Clara becoming increasingly detached from her life on Earth, becoming increasingly involved with her adventures with the doctor, learning sort of the lessons that the doctor has and sort of learning how to be a doctor and encouraging him to be a doctor when he doesn't really want to, when he just feels like running away from his responsibilities. And I think that focus on Clara and her story really worked to Series 9's benefit, because we got a lot of really amazing moments out of that. And we also saw a lot of questioning and subversion of a lot of really prominent tropes in Doctor Who, particularly Clara's whole death, not death, being an amazing subversion of the fridged women trope. And you also just had this incredible examination of what it would really mean to have a woman as the doctor, and focus on, you know, what would her story be like? What would her concerns be? And I just thought that was amazing.
I'm curious, because one of the things that we noticed in tandem with this, with the opportunities that were being given for the character, as far as now that we have a full realization of Clara and everything that she had the potential for, and as we were watching her, you know, obviously with Danny no longer in the picture, so there were no other ties that bind her to the simpler human life, so to speak. That we started seeing this addiction level to the adventure, to her own detriment, obviously, in the end. But at the same time, she was surrounded by a gathering of other really strong female roles that allowed her to, you know, again, we're going to go back to it, even though we don't be, for lack of a better tool at the moment, for the Bechdel test, allowing her to have interactions with other female actors that were not only extensive, powerful, story-driving, and many times more important to the situation at hand than anything in certain scenes within episodes, than anything that the Doctor was up to at the time. So that felt not only refreshing, but really momentous, in my opinion. Now, I this is going to allow me to back up a little bit. So we're starting, like, let's kind of take it back towards the top of the series here. And a lot of the time that she spends countering Gomez in the Missy role and all of their very bizarre cat and mouse games played within the first two episodes, where they spend very little time on screen with the Doctor at all. How did that stack up as far as both of your opinions? I mean, well, Haley, I kind of know how you feel on a lot of this. But as far as just saying, you know what, I could just sit back and watch this for 52 minutes.
There was just a lot of really stunning roles that women had this season. And every character felt incredibly engaging. You just wanted to know everything and more about them. You know, Michelle Gomez is just absolutely amazing as the Master. She plays the role in a way that you just, we've known this character almost since the beginning of the show, you know, in fairly early years. And it's still, it, like, she manages to refresh the role and make you think, again, that maybe you don't know everything about this character, then you want to know more about this version of the character. I think that it's wonderful every time that we get Kate Stewart on screen. I think that she is a wonderful, wonderful character that really we could see more of. And then we also just got incredible characters like Ashildur, or me, and the General, who we only saw for, you know, 5 minutes tops, but is already one of my favorite new characters from this past season that I want constantly in series 10. I don't care what I have to do. I will kickstart all the money in the world to bribe whoever I need to bribe to get her in more episodes. But I think I was just, we had so many incredible women filling these roles, and it was just, I think, inattentiveness to who are we giving these roles to? Can this role be played by a woman? You know, does it just reflect life to have more women in these roles? Even small, tiny roles managed to be filled out in a way that gave them a lot of depth and emotion. You had the drone operator from the Zygon episodes who, you know, pulls back at the last minute because the Zygons have reflected her husband and her son. And just little roles like that, that women could step in and fill, that brought... That had such depth to them, even though they were only on screen for 30 seconds. And I think that really helped. It really helped fill out the world of Doctor Who and show a lot of different types of characters. Because one of the things sort of people constantly get on female characters about is that they are never everything that you want them to be. There are too many conflicting expectations for female characters. There are too many conflicting problems that you need them to solve. And one woman cannot be the one character for us all. Like, we need lots of female characters to have lots of different roles for them to fill. And it just, this, the world of Doctor Who felt filled out in a way that it really hasn't for a while, that there are just lots of different female characters that I can be absorbed in and want to find out more about.
I'm glad you bring that up in particular, because it's a matter of you know, if you can't look to the one saving grace that's going to shift everything, here is one actor who puts forth such a character that everyone's minds are irrevocably changed. It's a matter of representation across the spectrum, from the one line, from the second lieutenant to, you know, back behind the console, to Cass. You know, in her representation of that episode, which, although there's a caveat at the end of that, they were, I'm not going to bring up the fact that they suddenly had to throw her in a romantic relationship, but whatever. Or as you mentioned, Tania Miller's performance as the 12th General. So these are cases where I'm hoping that this is now a matter of enough of a peppering across the I don't know, the class system of characters? I don't know, can you say that the characters kind of fall into a class system? You've got your unnamed, you're named with one line, you're involved in a conversation, and then your pivotal plot-driving characters and such. But such that it's no longer something that requires notice. That it doesn't strike you as exceptional or exemplary or unusual or something that requires commendation for, you know, good on you for doing that, because it's now it's being done everywhere and at all times. That's more of the neutrality versus equality kind of a stance, but
yeah. Well, it's still something that catches your eye because it's still so unusual. You know, it's people notice when there are more women present because it's so unusual to see actual equal representation. What's that? There's a study that maybe we'll have to put into show notes, but if women speak 50% of the time, people perceive them as speaking far more than that because it seems unusual to have women speaking in equal amounts. Like, it's going to catch our eye for some time, and it's just going to take an adjustment period to be used to that. But I think it's also something, you know, worth celebrating and applauding, because it's so easy to fall back on old habits and not have women in these roles. Sort of reminds me of the story about Star Wars. We spoke about Force Awakens earlier. Force Awakens took great pains to show women in a lot of background roles, particularly as pilots with the Resistance. And in the original Star Wars movie, A New Hope, there were lots of women pilots originally filmed to be part of the rebellion, and they were removed in editing. And the one woman who was shown on screen, her line was dubbed over by a man. Like, it is just, it is that easy to cut women out of these visible roles. So, yeah, it sort of seems like a sad comment to say, woohoo, we're celebrating, you know, almost being at equal representation, but we have to. We have to let everyone know we're paying attention. Keep up the good work.
Mm. Okay. Well, as far as giving those opportunities for those characters to come forward, I mean, not only just the credit given to the talent for their means of giving that weight and that reality to these characters, regardless of the scale of their importance to the individual episodes, we also have the individuals on the other side of the camera who are seeing that happen. Now, granted, a lot of the characters that we're referring to, and as far as the opportunities that we're seeing where they're really shining on screen, were done, if you want to consider it unexpectedly or not, as a result of a script that was put forth by a male writer, or under the creative eye of a male director. Now, we've had also some phenomenal work from breakout writers for the program this season. I'm thinking specifically Catherine Tregana and Sarah Dollard, who out of the box on their freshman episodes have given us two phenomenal pieces of work with The Woman Who Lived and Face the Raven, respectively. Which I want to personally say are the two feathers in the cap for this series.
Was that a Raven pun?
No, it wasn't even intentional. But I'm going to write that down. But as far as, no, because I'm not, because then you get into all sorts of goose and gander jokes and it just goes on from there.
Oh, no.
But this is something that tells me that, because we thought it was so exceptional that we were gonna have women writers back into a more regular rotation with the program, obviously, and then from the director's standpoint, you know, with everything we saw with Hayden McDonald, the return of Rachel Talalay, who we love, and everything that they've been able to do for material that they are handed and say, give this creative vision, the underlying story, and the fact I'm specifically looking at Dollard's script for Face the Raven. And Haley and I and Jay, we went on and on and on about this. We practically, you know, should have just packaged ourselves and be left on our doorstep so we could sing her songs all night or something, because it was just it was an example of an individual who came forward and said, "All right, you're giving me my first shot with this. I'm going to show you how I not only know the material, I honor the material, I love the material, and I want to further the material in a way that does it justice and keeps it an art form in its own right. I want to tell a beautiful story regardless of what universe I'm writing this within. But I'm also going to do so in a way that meets some of my personal goals." And obviously a lot of that has to do with her desire to see a gender equality within the character Wait. So Clara is just beautifully written within this one, even down to some of the supporting characters. You know, the daughter who has to hide her gender, you know, within this strange little pocket of society and so forth. So just amazing material being addressed. So is this giving us an opportunity to pursue this further? I mean, as far as, you know, these were critical successes. So is it something where, again, we're hoping that we're moving the envelope forward so that this isn't something that we have to consciously address. We just do it.
You know, I hope so. You know, one of the amazing yet sad facts about Series 9 is that it actually sets the record for the most women writing and directing in a single season of Doctor Who, with two women writers and two women directors. And, you know, I hope that we continue to push forward. And I think that one of the best things that could be done for future seasons is to have so many women writing and directing for this one, because it is more likely that you'll go with someone that you know and that you like, then you're going to take a chance on someone new. And now that those women are firmly in the wheelhouse, they're more likely to be asked back. You know, Rachel Talalay was brought back after the amazing job that she did with the Series 8 finale. Hedy McDonald did Blink, so she obviously had an amazing track record with the show. Catherine Jagena was a little bit reluctant, as I understand, to work on Doctor Who. She had done some incredible work with Torchwood, but for some reason was just not really that interested in doing Doctor Who. So, you know, I hope that her experience with the show this time around has encouraged her to maybe give us a chance in future seasons. And Sarah Dollar was just stunning. Just Face the Raven is... Oh, God, I can't even pick from the finale episodes. All of the finale episodes are my favorite. Face the Raven has a very, very good shot of being my bet, my absolute favorite from this season. It's just amazing. So I hope that the critical response to her episode will make it so that someone will consider bringing her back in future seasons. So I think that, you know, this season has helped push the envelope further. I hope we continue to take chances on new women writers and directors in future seasons, because that's the only way we address the long-term gender imbalance in the industry. But man, I hope we get some of the women that we're writing and directing this season back in future episodes.
I didn't put this in the notes, but it's actually, it kind of bears bringing up, because you mentioned, you know, bringing up writers, directors, other principal creative representation from Torchwood, you know, so we have a sort of extended universe or spin-off programs that are serving as a farm team to bring things up. And I also think that if you look back historically, you had a long stretch where even if from a producer standpoint, director standpoint, writer standpoint, that they were not allowing a lot of women to take on these roles within Doctor Who proper, post 2005, if you looked at the Sarah Jane Adventures, that was being used as an opportunity of a bit of a sandbox that they were working within, and we continue to see them involved in some capacity within the program proper to this day. I'm wondering if maybe with the upcoming spinoff plans for Class under Patrick Ness's helm, that, well, not his helm, but his involvement, that they'll have that same thought to use it as well. We do have these individuals that we had kind of promised some work to within the upcoming series for Doctor Who itself, but we also have the spinoff program, so somebody who's still testing their mettle, so to speak, will have an opportunity to do so. Have you given any done any time looking into what's going to be going into Class? Are you up to speed with it right now?
Yeah, I think I'm as up to speed as anyone can be. I think mostly it's just a waiting game now to see who they're going to bring on. So I certainly hope that it'll be used as a place where women writers and directors can come in, and that maybe this gives them a platform to jump into Doctor Who. That would certainly be wonderful. I think that, as you said, maybe we should look a little bit more to who was working on Sarah Jane Adventures and Torchwood and see if any of them can be brought in to Doctor Who proper as well.
I want to try to involve a little bit of some of the feedback that we got from listeners on this particular topic before we start breaking outside of the Doctor Who universe here, because this is actually it's going to loop us back in momentarily, and I'll preface that right off the get-go. But we had a conversation going with a couple of friends and listeners from the program. We'll use their pseudonyms for the sake of their anonymity and such. So we had kind of posed the question out there, and our friend Badger had chimed in to say that he felt that there were more. It seemed that there were more women in total, just in terms of quantity over quality, I suppose, in some of the classic Who serials. But he didn't feel that they'd ever been better or more or fully represented than now. Since this was a sort of a thread conversation, our friend Soleil chimed in and said that he would like to think that Doctor Who is just keeping with the times, and this is just indicative of a cultural shift and an awakening of sorts. So when you take things like The Force Awakens or the ongoing, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I'm going to tie Haley in here in a second. So the representation of women in film and television is transitioning from just some sort of an objectification that they might have been utilized as the damsel in distress during the classic era into being fully realized characters and individuals. So, and here's where he starts to offend us a bit, because he says, I can't speak for Dusty Who. I never met Dusty Who. I'm not sure who he is. But
the Doctor's cousin, Dusty.
Yeah, it is. Dusty. Dusty Bottoms. He's part of the Three Amigos. But New Who has always had strong female characters, in his estimation. So he says, I think for Who, what has changed is the depth of character being represented and being allowed to happen. Badger's just response, he just kind of chides him for a second. In classic Who, women were just as likely as men to be idiots compared to the Doctor. And just, you know, the way they're being, you know, Harry is an idiot or an imbecile. Except in the instances where you had time ladies like Romana and the Rani, who more often than not handily outsmarted him. And that starts getting into some of the evil queen tropes, where if you're going to have a woman of any sort of intellect, she obviously has to be an evil character or something of that sort. I'm going to hand this back to the two of you, because I know that you both have a bit of an affinity for Missy. And I'm glad that Badger brought up the Rani, because now you've got time lady representation that is almost falling back on to a certain degree on that evil queen trope. But there's a defense to be made for what Michelle Gomez has done with Missy. And I'd love to hear both of your take on how this is a different game.
You know, there's a bit of a validity to that sort of critique that a lot of the very intellectual characters are sort of evil characters. But I think that there's also, when you look at the totality of it, plenty of intelligent, competent, capable women that are either anti-heroes or a bit more of neutral characters or are firmly on the side of good. You know, you have River Song, who is a time lady in her own right, half human, but still a time lady, that she is just as capable of using the TARDIS as the Doctor is. In fact, probably even a better pilot. She is just as...
She knows what all the buttons do.
Turn off the flipping parking brake when she is flying the TARDIS.
What do you mean all the other times?
And I think that there are a lot of other very intelligent characters that come up against the Doctor that are women. I think that I get a little bit protective of the classic Who women in particular. I love Jo Grant to pieces, and while there are certainly a lot of problematic aspects of the way that women were used in classic Who, they were certainly not all damsels in distress, and many of them did have very in-depth, emotional, complicated character arcs that maybe they weren't always consistent, but if we're, you know, critiquing characters for consistency, we could also probably point out that Clara wasn't very consistent at the beginning of her arc either.
You don't say.
Yes. So, you know, I think that we go in cycles. We go into times where there are lots of women that they have very interesting, in-depth roles, that the characters are complicated and engaging. And we have times where there's just a few women. And maybe we're on an upswing, and hopefully it's a permanent upswing in which we have lots of female characters that are engaging and complex and not all villainous. And maybe most of them are intelligent, but maybe they're not intelligent, just like guys can be intelligent and not intelligent. But I think that to argue that all of the intelligent women are villains sort of ignores the many competent, capable, intelligent women that aren't villains. And the Doctor may speak down to some women sometimes, but that doesn't certainly mean that they're less intelligent than him.
Okay. And I think they've given a great degree of complexity to Missy's character right now, as far as where they really stand, as far as their friendship, their frenemy standing, or however that is. They've made it so complex and so intriguing that I don't know if it necessarily can even fall within that particular stereotypical bucket any longer. So, Haley, thoughts on this one?
I mean, yeah, you could say, you know, Missy falls into the evil queen trope, but look at the character she came out of. It's not like she was going to be anything but delightfully evil.
Yeah, the master was a trope in and of itself from the get-go.
Right. Yeah. And like Alyssa said, she's not the only character we're seeing. If she was the only character we're seeing, yes, that would be problematic. But that's one of the benefits of the more recent series, is that you don't have just one representation for intelligent women. If you've got more than one, then you can play on some tropes and then do something unique and interesting with some other characters.
Mm. I'm glad that we have this opportunity to see a lot of these barriers break down. We referenced things like some of the massive changes within public awareness within The Force Awakens and some other. Well, there's been a large amount of other content that's been handed to us within the last 8 months. Well, no, I'll go back a little farther than that, because I'm actually, if I want to include things like some of the network series that have been given to us, the Getting Away with Murder and Grey's Anatomy and those things, which have been, you know, I don't even know what season Grey's Anatomy is into at this point.
It's double digits.
Yeah, but basically anything that Shonda Rhimes has put her hands on is considered to be, even though they are very formulaic, even though to a certain degree they are not necessarily the best example of what you would consider feminist content, it is, as far as what is being generated, what has weight and merit and voice within the industry, it's shifting considerably. But then I also want to look to things like some of the things being put forth by the independent distribution networks like Netflix. Orange is the New Black comes immediately to mind, and then more recently Jessica Jones. Now, I know we're jumping way out of universe here, but Haley, with your Marvel credit to your name here, and Alyssa, I know that you're a pretty avid consumer of material that isn't necessarily Whovian in nature. Are we looking at a cultural shift in some of these other universes, these other opportunities that are just going to make it even easier for legacy programs like Doctor Who to be able to move forward in comfortable surrounding?
I think what the media of the past year has really shown us is that women are marketable and women can make you a lot of money. And it sounds very cynical, but the argument from Hollywood for years has been that female protagonists don't sell, that nobody wants to see a woman as a hero on screen. And you have so many movies and TV shows coming out now where the woman is just absolutely front and center, the protagonist, it's her story, and they are critical and commercial successes. And there is no place to argue anymore that something, a franchise will fail if it is helmed by a woman. And I think that the most important thing coming out of this for Doctor Who is mostly that people cannot continue to argue that the Doctor cannot be portrayed as a woman and say that the show will fail commercially and that it will suffer with its fan base. I just don't think that argument is viable anymore. We have seen franchises as old as Star Wars come out with a woman as the main protagonist of the show, of the movie, sorry, and people come out in droves to see it. It is setting commercial records. It is a critical success. You have TV shows like Jessica Jones putting just explicitly feminist stories about women and trauma and survival and just generally about women's interactions with society and with men on a daily basis. And people are just consuming it, just jumping in and loving the show. So I think that really where Doctor Who is now with this media environment is a place where it's really safe to have not just safe, but necessary for its survival and commercially viable to have women taking on such prominent roles, including maybe potentially that of the doctor one day.
Now, Haley, you're in an interesting position on this because one of the other areas of content that you do a lot of podcast hosting on has to do with the new Supergirl series. So where yes. does that fit in right now? I know there was almost a point where a lot of the conventional wisdom was trying to pit efforts like Supergirl and Jessica Jones against one another.
Right, because, you know, we can only have one female superhero in all of television and film.
Just
That's
one.
That's all there is room for. Just one. And so we've got to pick which one we want. No, it's silly. And look at other shows like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is, I don't know if it's 50%, but if it isn't, it's pretty close to the 50% of the cast is women. And you've got Arrow, which, yeah, the front runner of that show is a guy, but then there's two other female superheroes on the team, too. Mm-hmm. So it seems like with television, there's been a lot of room for women to step forward and take the roles in traditionally more male-dominated genres. But when it comes to movies, that's where they're more hesitant, which is why they probably keep pushing back Captain Marvel and the fact that they're trying to break my poor geek heart. But
I'll be there suffering with you.
We're never going to see it. It's never happening.
We'll just sit there sobbing outside the theater.
We'll just start taping comic book pages to the movie screen. It'll be fine.
We can make a stop motion version. It'll be okay.
Oh boy. Well, and that's just it. I mean, this is the second time I've heard conversations that are saying, you know, for anybody that's trying to break ground, anybody that's trying to take chances, anyone that's trying to push the envelope right now, it used to be the point where they would look to to the cinema to do so. But now it's a matter of if they want to test something out, or if they want to really, you know, move something forward, they're going to do so on some of these television projects, whether it be miniseries or some sort of a short run pilot series on an alternative broadcast network and things of that sort. And then if it proves its merit, it gets moved up to cinematic status.
Well, the stakes are so much lower in television. I mean, you're looking at a few million dollars maybe for a pilot, whereas with a movie, you're looking at tens of millions of dollars. Mm. Even for lower budget movies now, that's the type of budget they're looking at.
So the question becomes, especially because of the fact that we're down to, what, there are maybe four major media outlets that own everything at this point. So if part of their pie is sitting there and watching their successes at the televised level, how many instances need to be put into their hands where they realize, okay, well, this can work on the large screen as well. We're willing to take that risk. And granted, I know, folks, I'm sorry, listeners, we're drifting so far away from Doctor Who at the moment, but we're really not, because there's always been the thought on the table that they were going to have an actual cinematic release. So I'm not so far off the mark right now.
They're also pushing it by continuing to release the episodes in cinemas, so they're going for the cinematic feel here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if we move even farther towards the Sherlock model, so that you're getting nothing but one 90-minute episode every 4 months or so...
Don't you dare even suggest that.
It wasn't me!
PCAP suggested that, right?
Don't shoot the messenger. Go yell at the Scotsman. It wasn't my fault.
This is a terrible idea. Oh.
Well, just the same. So... if anything that you can take away from this, you can see that this is a much larger discussion that has a lot of tangential topics attached to it that can be full-blown discussions in and of their own right. And we intend to absolutely address it farther, because as we are at this quiet period where every little bit of Series 10 news that gets handed to us is going to be, you know, some beautifully wrapped gift for at least the next couple of months, then we can sit back and rely on wild fan speculation like we're all want to do. So,
also, we're due for at least three more Moffat rants before the new series starts.
Oh, at least.
'Cause the man does not know how to take criticism at all.
No.
I'm sure one of them will be from me.
You notice he's starting to put up his family as a human shield more often now? Asks his wife, can you go out and tweet something, please? Or he tells his son, go do some sort of a beautiful home video or something that I can put up on YouTube just to deflect for a few minutes. Would you please just take one for Dad? Okay.
Did you see the article in Time magazine that came out, and he was just talking about telling all of the writers not to be on Twitter at all, just because, like, he said that, what was it, the praise will kill you and the hate will also kill you. Just, that's a guy that just does not like engaging with the internet.
Yeah, and as my counter argument, I will point to Sarah Dollard.
Yeah.
Done. I will drop my microphone and moonwalk out of the room because she is prolific on the social networks. She engages her fan base on a regular basis, positively and negatively. She takes critique like a champion and does not let it incorporate. And she's willing to share. I mean, she breaks a fourth wall. You know, I remember when she was getting down to her final edits and ready for script submission for Face the Raven, she was tweeting about how she felt like she was going to throw up on her shoes on a regular basis because the nerves were getting to her so badly. Not because of what she had written. She was absolutely certain about it, but just the experience of having to go through this for the first time. So that sort of front-facing persona and that sort of attachment to the public eye is glorious, and I wish more writers did it. You know, we get this opportunity to chat with some other writers. Well, you know, Toby Whithouse is relatively approachable. Paul Cornell is a friend of ours that we love discussing with, and I hope that it continues. Catherine Tregana, we can't really get her on Twitter or anything, but you know, somebody can create her account and say, here, we got you something. Merry Christmas.
Yeah, I think that you have to have a bit of a thick skin on the internet. You know, I could share horrifying hate messages that I get through Tumblr pretty consistently. It's just, it is a thing that happens, but the benefits of engaging with this fandom are so much greater than any of that.
By all means.
Yeah. We've got some of that kind of mail too.
Yeah. Oh, we should swap stories sometime.
It's a rite of passage, and it made us feel special.
Maybe do it over a glass of wine or something at Galley.
Sold.
Done.
Sold. Haley and I will both be there, so we'll see you. Shall we get to our news?
Let's do it.
Probably.
Probably. If you got nothing else to do. Okay. Well, okay. We're going to take these in no particular order, but we've got some interesting stuff. It's funny. You know, we thought it was going to be really quiet during the Series 9 aftermath, but it looks like we still have things that we can discuss. Thankfully, one of my personal favorite people out there right now, Sean Pertwee, was asked, if you remember when he did Halloween cosplay as his dad and shared those things, and the resemblance went from uncanny into downright creepy and things. Well, he was asked outright whether or not he would ever consider actually portraying his doctor, his father as the doctor, or some other involvement within the program. And he actually declined the opportunity, saying that it was something where it was not a matter of kind of trying to fill those shoes. His dad was his own doctor. I mean, well, how can you not say that? That's, you know, well, which just kind of breaks your heart there to a certain degree. But he said he did leave the door open, and I'm really glad that he said this, that, you know, because of a lot of the things they do, the tribute programs and specials that they do where they sit down with cast and crew and family members and things and talk about the legacy of the program, that he'd be involved in something to that degree because it's part of that iconic status that makes you British. So the door's not completely closed. You're just not going to see him in the cloak again unless he's, you know, unless it's Halloween.
I just have this real strong wish that he just shows up as a brief cameo. Doesn't even have a line, but, you know, gets to see the 12th Doctor, who looks so much like Pertwee, going for the coat and the hair and everything. I just want a cameo where the 12th Doctor and Sean Pertwee as the 3rd Doctor can just sort of wink and acknowledge each other. That's all I want in life, but I guess I will have to live without it.
Well, you'd want him as a cameo, but as the 3rd Doctor, rather than just giving him sort of a walk-on role?
I could go with either.
So imagine you've got some scenario where there's some murder investigation in a space opera. Okay.
Oh man.
So there's some tenor dead on the floor, and Capaldi's doctor picks up the cloak and like whips it around his shoulders real quick, looks over and says, "Nah, it'll never work," and he goes to put it down, and off in the dusky shadows behind the wings, there's Sean Pertwee pushing a broom and going, "Yeah, mate, you look a complete twat." And just moves off. Come on.
Okay,
maybe,
I would do that.
Maybe for one of those, what is it, something relief specials they do
the
for charity?
Red Nose specials, yeah.
Oh, we could get him for comic relief, right? He'd do that. It's for the kids.
Come on, it's for kids, dude. It's charity. You have to now.
Yep.
We'll write him a sternly worded letter right now.
Yes.
All right. Well, the next item we've got on here is actually something for all of us who spend too much time on the interwebs. BBC America listened and gave us our own show.
With blackjack and hookers?
With blackjack and hookers. No. With Twitter and the doctor. So are either of you familiar with this rollout and what this is going to mean for us, this doctor's notes? Tell us what you know.
As far as I know, it looks like they're taking comments that were made about the episodes when they were airing and, like, putting them in as sort of, like, an annotated version of the episode that they'll be airing.
Like, pop-up video?
I don't know if it's, like, pop-up video or something like that, but, like, I was contacted about having one of my random tweets appear on a special kind of thing, and it sounds like it's going to be for this kind of thing, so I don't know. I think that's what it's going to be, like fan input being annotated onto these episodes.
Yeah. I mean, as far as I understand here, they're going back from the jump. They're going to take the ninth season and they're going to run it through, because obviously at this point, the sheer volume of social outlet that releases every time, or live tweeting, Facebook reactions, Tumblr reposts and so forth, get so frantic that they've got, I can't imagine the tomes of material that they can potentially use for a lot of these things, but they say they're being done as episode rebroadcasts. So the fan commentary, I would imagine, be sort of an on-screen crawler or something that goes through. So it doesn't interrupt the flow of the episode, but it's something as if you were sitting there with virtually a couple thousand other individuals who are, you know, spouting off live time as you are reacting to the episodes. So, well, Alyssa, specifically, do you remember the specific tweet that they contacted you about for inclusion?
Yeah, it was a tweet from Face the Raven, and it was something that I put out while I was live tweeting the episode, and the only thing I said was, "Damn, Mayor Me laying down the law." So, I don't know. That was the tweet that they contacted me about. I don't know if they're looking at anything else, but it looks like they're just putting in fan reactions into the episode. If that's what my tweet was for, they said a special, so it could be anything. I think it's this thing.
Right. Okay. Well, then that's going to be kicking off the end of this month, so it'll be airing on Saturdays, starting on the 30th, and here in the States, it'll be in the evening hours. So it's going to be one of the staples of their of their broadcast schedule. I mean, you're putting this on primetime, granted on a Saturday, but it's still primetime in what would have been the Doctor Who slot. So now you're getting your standard rebroadcast with our own inclusions. So we share our thinks with your thinks.
Did you demand royalties for the use of your tweet?
Yeah, demand my whole 5 cents for including a publicly available tweet. I should have done it.
Well, just plugs. Nothing but plugs. I'll take my payment in plugs.
I will take my payment in plugs, believe me.
Speaking of plugging, and I'm saying this as my segue point because it seems like we get these things on a regular basis, and I have to wonder how often these are circulated as a result of an agent who says, "You know, it'd be great to really push you out there right now. Put your hat in the ring to be the next doctor." Tim Roth steps forward and ever so graciously says, "Oh, yeah, well, if asked, I'd certainly be interested in playing the next Doctor." Okay. So would 75% of the nation of Great Britain and a large portion of Hollywood at the moment. So is this actually news? Or is this just a matter of propelling one's career placement by keeping your name relevant?
Yeah. I think it's more placement.
Mm. Yeah.
to take nothing away from Tim Roth, I mean, I've seen a lot of his exceptional work, and I do agree with the statement that because Capaldi has opened the doors for spikier, edgier, more mature individuals to play the role, but I don't know. I think if you were to give me 100 blanks on a page, I don't think Tim Roth's name would be anywhere within that 100.
No. I actually had to click on the link to make sure. Tim Roth is the person I'm thinking of, right?
It just seems like that perennial thing that comes up of, do you want to be the next Doctor? Has anybody asked you? No, you want to say it anyways. Kind of thing.
Okay. Well, then we'll move right past it. We won't give him any more airtime than he deserves. The hell with you, Roth. All right. Next item. And more importantly to us, is Missy going to be back in Series 10? Well, that...
I hope so.
That kind of strikes me as a giant duh. Am I wrong?
I mean, she's certainly going to be back. They left a pretty dang sharp cliffhanger there for her character. Like, you gotta do something with that.
Absolutely. But the question becomes, and it's the nature of this particular... this article that came about as a result of... when they were airing the Christmas episode in New York City, Moffat actually attended and did a Q&A session with some bizarre lights that were not exactly cooperating during the panel, and they were sort of in this strange Manhattan strobe effect for a little while. But once they got the lighting all figured out and they were able to actually have a decent Q&A, he addressed a lot of topics regarding the close of the series and little bits about what was going to be going into the next series. Granted, she is too much of a commodity to leave tabled for too long. But I guess the question becomes, how quickly do you put her back into the series? I was almost surprised that we did not utilize Missy beyond episode 2 of this series. Now, granted, in retrospect, I don't really know where else you might have been able to fit her effectively, but I'm really surprised that her being the popularity juggernaut that she is right now, that she wasn't used more readily. Not to the point of exhausting the Master as we've had in the past, but just to tap into it, or at least name check every once in a while.
They could have probably worked her in somewhere at the end with Gallifrey.
Mm,
but exactly. Other than that, I don't see where they would have.
Okay.
Yeah, well, it could be that it's one of the things that they can now explore now that Gallifrey's back, because we still have that sort of open question of, well, if Gallifrey was locked, then how did Missy get out? Right. And, you know, how did she get involved now, and how did she survive her last confrontation with Rassilon? Like, there's a lot of questions that I think now can sort of be answered.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there wasn't really a place to fit her otherwise in Series 9. And it feels like she's one of the characters that you always want to see more of, but you have to use a little bit sparingly.
Mm. And, you know, I'm thinking of this now, with the way they closed out the Christmas special with River's story, I'm never going to get to see River and Missy and the Doctor on the TARDIS glaring at each other.
Damn, now I just realized that.
Yeah, there's all sorts of really painful realizations with that Christmas special. I'm really sorry. Listen, we completely jumped over River's character. We didn't get a chance to really bring that into the discussion proper. But in a sort of a quick synopsis, are you okay with the River Song arc?
Oh boy. I am happy where it has ended. I have fallen sort of madly in and out of love with River Song's arc throughout her time on the show. I loved her in her introductory episodes. I sort of cringed throughout the Wedding of River Song and the Angels Take Manhattan, and now I'm in a good, happy place with her again. I think that River is an amazing character who, in recent episodes, has been shown with having some very unhealthy, sort of terrible behaviors around the Doctor. Never let him see you age, never let him see the damage. And I think that the Christmas special was a really good way of, you know, maybe pointing out that they both sort of see each other as being these sort of monoliths that are sort of very difficult to love because they seem so impressive and large in your head. But I I'm okay now. I was glad that she was sort of treated with a little bit more respect this episode and, you know, didn't say terrible things like never let him see you age. But it's been a rough ride with me and River.
Even though she's the better pilot to begin with. She's
got lots of amazing qualities to her. You know, she's just this character that on paper seems like I should just absolutely fall in love with her. And, you know, then she says terrible things like that. And I'm just sitting there going, I'm sorry, you just had this character say what now?
Mm.
Those moments are hard for me because it seems to be promoting such an unhealthy attitude towards relationships that never really gets questioned or addressed again. It's just said like it's one of those truisms you say about the doctor. And that just bothers me because if River's supposed to be the, you know, one of the women who knows him best, who's his wife, why doesn't she puncture the myth a little bit more? Why does she buy into some of these things? So those sort of just niggle with me.
Mm, that's absolutely understandable. Have you had an opportunity to explore any of the new audiobook content that's been provided from Big Finish?
Not yet. There is a lot of Big Finish that I have on my wish list. I'm still trying to get through all of Classic Who, so I have got a lot of content to get through.
We've got a project coming up this summer, winter.
Yes.
Winter and summer. All the time where there's not new Who.
I'm working on it.
We're dragging Haley kicking and screaming at times through Classic Who.
It's not kicking and screaming. I tried to do it on my own. I just petered out.
Well, you're also trying to pull yourself through Classic Marvel at the same time. And there's only so many hours in the day if you don't have a vortex manipulator on hand.
Good Lord, you've really bitten off quite a bit there.
I know. It's just like, all the content. Let's start it all at the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, she's a completionist freak. So
a little bit.
Good luck.
Well, speaking of completing things and making sure that everything gets assembled in full, of all the most unlikely places, a writer over for the Houston Press here in the States decided to take the recently now retail available Why Don't You Own Five of Them Yet Lego TARDIS interiors and put it up against the Character Builders TARDIS interior set that's been available for some time. Even though it's a little hard to get here stateside, you can acquire it. You're just going to pay a little bit more. And did a great little breakout pitting the two of them against one another as far as their construction quality, as far as their scale and attention to detail, and all things under the sun. An interesting little read. We'll make sure that we include that for you to play with. But one of the upshots is the fact that the Character Builder set for the dollar is massive in comparison to the Lego set. And we all suffer through this, the fact that, you know, what is it? Like a 300-piece Lego set is going to cost you a minimum $30. It's like 10 cents a piece or so that you pay. Some crazy scale like that, which is really unusual because we've got one of the Lego factories here in my home state, as well as their marketing arm actually functions out of here. And I know a lot of their package designers and things, and they just giggle to themselves over the markup on these things. And limited availability.
Because the plastic costs nothing at all.
Yeah. And even the license rights to acquiring these things, you say, you know, if you're going to take on major, major content like the Star Wars line or the Doctor Who line or something of that sort. And even that doesn't justify. I mean, this isn't like these are not life-saving pharmaceuticals that we're developing here where we have to offset production costs. It's just not there.
Yeah, there's not 30 years of R&D put into this.
No. So I'm going to stick this thing on that thing and give you a label that makes it look like a weeping angel. Awesome.
Well, they know they can get the fans for every penny they've got.
Absolutely. And it's not as if we're going to direct you towards people who do custom minifigure creation, although we do know individuals who do custom figure creations, and they make amazing stuff. I'm just saying they're out there to be found. But things that you cannot find, and we'll use this as our closing thing here, because it was a video that I spent a few minutes at work that I really should have been doing more constructive things that I'm actually paid to do, but I couldn't help it because it was freaking amazing. Were the folks over at Hampton's Handcrafted Lightsabers. Yes, lightsabers. I'm discussing lightsabers on a Doctor Who cast, but to hell with you. To hell with you! Because they created a sonic screwdriver saber, sonic saber, sonic like screwed foot.
Screw saber?
Screws. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Hyphenate that however you choose. That is extremely impressive. And the creator himself sits there in the YouTube clip that we will put in the show notes for you to enjoy and goes through the entire assembly process and explains everything and all the labor of love that went into it. So you can tell that this guy does what he loves, loves what he does, and creates amazing content that you probably can't afford. So there you go, because they're done on limited runs, custom to order. So, but you can just stare at it and, you know, just kind of wipe the drool from the side of your mouth or whatever it is you need to do.
Did anyone think that the new sonic screwdriver looked like a lightsaber?
I don't.
Was I the only one in that?
I don't. No, I didn't. I didn't pull on that particular parallel. It looks. I'm just looking at it from a fabricator's standpoint to say that's going to be extremely complicated to put out on the toy market at an affordable price point.
Yeah.
Because it does a lot more than just an LED bulb.
Yeah. But, again, they know they can get us for every penny we've got.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to get one as soon as I can.
One? It has a red mode. Come on! I mean, that's worth at least an extra... I'm sorry, this is going to cost $45. Okay, that's $45, but it's an extra $15 for the red mode. Okay!
Okay, well, here.
Well, duh. Of course.
Any other DLC for the new Sonic screwdriver?
Exactly. Because obviously I have to help you offset your production costs on this wonderful piece of equipment. And $15 for a red light bulb versus the blue light bulb makes perfect sense.
Because I can't get that at the hardware store.
Hell no.
Insert shut up and take my money GIF here.
Yes.
Well, there you have it. In all of its chaotic glory, this has been episode 169 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Alyssa, thank you so much for joining us. This has been an absolute pleasure having you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's been fantastic talking with you guys. And if anyone wants to check me out and keep talking about anything with me, you can find me on Tumblr or Twitter at Whovian Feminism.
Excellent. Tumblr and Twitter. I suggest both, because that way Tumblr is not limited to the extent of your blog posts, which are fascinating reads in and of themselves. Thank you so much for your most recent post on our finales.
Oh, my goodness. So thank you for reading that novel.
Well, you braced us for it. We had a warning tweet up front. Okay, I'm about to publish this. Okay, I published this. I'm going to give you a few minutes.
Sorry about that. Thanks for reading.
Sorry, I'm not sorry. But yes, so and as Haley mentioned, when we reconvene next week, we are going to go back to the beginning, back into time, and actually back up to our classic rewatch, starting from the outset with An Unearthly Child, which I'm going to have a blast with. I absolutely love the story. And I hope that that you'll be able to have the opportunity to enjoy it as well. We are still a little bit fluid as far as the nature of how we're going to conduct our classic rewatch, knowing that we have the missing episode gaps. So we'll be addressing that as we go. But if you have some input on what you'd like us to go through, as far as if you want us to do sort of highlights of and do a little skipping around, or if you want us to go through it chronologically and we'll just take quick summary jumps when we get to those missing episodes, we're certainly open to those suggestions as well. Feel free to reach us through the various social channels that'll be provided with you during the outro. So, we good? We're good. Okay.
We're good.
All right. So, until next week on Gallifrey Public Radio, this is Kier saying, you know what? You take it. Haley, it's all you.
This is Haley saying, there's really only room for one damsel in this show.
I forgot about the whole damsel thing. Damn it! That was perfect in the Christmas episode. Sorry. Alyssa, have you got anything that you can close us out with?
Sure. And this is Alyssa saying, look forward to all of your messages and your hate mail.
Yeah. Well, have yourself a great week, folks. We'll talk to you soon. On Zoom.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2016.
Now, typically we kind of hang around for an extra couple of minutes, do our little GPR After Dark as a little coda that we stick on to the credits. We'll keep it kind of brief because I know that we all want to get back to our lives and stuff, and Haley's probably got like 19 podcasts to edit and such.
That's probably true.
Yeah, I picked that number.
That
out of
exact
my head.
Figure is probably true.
Yes, I won the pool. What's the next content that you've got to that you have to get out there for us, Alyssa?
I've got to finish my review of The Husbands of River Song, which you basically got the preview of that review right there. So.
Awesome.
Yeah, it is going to be hard to get that done, and I've got like 50 other posts that are rattling around that need to get finished. So it's going to be busy.
That's all right. Well, we'll let you get back to it.
I have one question for Alyssa, because we kind of talked about this.
Yeah.
Do you think that the new Star Wars movie passed the Bechdel test?
Oh, good Lord. I would say that yes, it does pass the Bechdel test.
Okay.
I also think that, and this was something I kept thinking to talk about in the podcast and just like, never found a good moment to say it. The Bechdel test is, you know, this very imperfect method of judging feminism in a series. And I usually like to view it as a whole series rather than focus on one particular episode of something. So if, you know, we talk about the history of the Bechdel test in Star Wars in general, it's horrible. But we have this episode that gets, you know, pretty much does it for me. You know, there's enough conversation there that, and enough other background women that have really great roles that I just think, you know, this is a pretty clear win for the franchise as a whole.
Right. What would you say as far as, you know, we keep prefacing the fact that it's an imperfect tool and that it fails on certain regards, or that it's not conclusive enough or thorough enough. Is there anything out there that is maybe not as well recognized or at least socially accepted right now, or at least I should say, you know, CW accepted, that may serve as a better indicator? I mean,
you know, there's no real one test just because it means so many different things for so many different people. And, you know, I think it serves as a handy way of looking at women's roles and just sort of the quantity and the barest quality that you can possibly measure, which is the volume of their conversation that is not about men. So I think that it's such a handy common touch point for people, and it is just the lowest of the low bars that a piece of media can clear, that I just don't think we have anything better right now, especially because every other measure is so subjective. In terms of whether somebody thinks it's necessary or valuable in a piece of media. So as imperfect a tool as it may be, it still has its uses for now, because we can't even clear the Bechdel test so many times.
Yeah. Well, but I'm wondering, though, whether we may get to a point where there's some sort of a composite that we can put together that utilizes, okay, well, this is an evaluation of screen time. This is an evaluation of dialogue content. This is an evaluation of relevance to plot development or any other kind of indicators that you can use, that collectively when you meta reference them, you can say, all right, on all of these scales, you know, so it takes granted, I still appreciate the fact that, the Bechdel test at its core is really saying take the topic of conversation as your driving point, or the fact that this needs to be your principal anchor for the sake of this evaluation, and say, do you even need to have a male character in the mix whatsoever, whether referenced, whether used as a point of foundation for the characters? And I know that gets to be kind of a gray area within things like Force Awakens in its most recent evaluation. So I'm wondering whether over time instead of just dismissing it, we use it along with a handful of other evaluations to get a more definitive understanding.
Did you kind of go through that statistics article that you posted?
Yeah.
Because that's just one of several things that they evaluated.
Yep. And I thought that was pretty interesting, the way that they put that composite together. Since we're mentioning this in the After Dark, I'll make sure that it's in the notes there. But it's a breakout of a sexist evaluation of the 50 years of the time when this particular write-up was being done. So it was taking it at the point where we were closing out the Matt Smith era. So it used the test as part of its evaluation, but at the same time, it also did things like re-rating them by severity of failures to the test, or whether you were looking at the ratio of male to female characters within the episodes as portrayed. And I think the last time around was, what was it, the... Oh, the... And then it actually, it cross-referenced the two. The severity of Bechdel successes and failures against the amount of male character representation within the episodes versus female in that ratio. So when you actually take the two of them and link them across, it was actually showing that some of the worst periods were the Pertwee years.
Yeah.
And the best were actually the Ninth Doctor's season.
Yeah. Well, it sort of goes back to that narrative question and how intentional you're being about it, because the Pertwee years are the unit-heavy years. So you tend to have one female character, maybe you get a few more, and just sort of really ironically and weirdly, I know it's for me especially, Pertwee years are some of my favorite years. But it's just a matter of, there's a lot of episodes where there's just nobody other than Joe really speaking. And Joe gets fantastic moments. You know, Joe gets a moment where she tells the Draconians, you know, time to bring some women's liberation to Draconia. And you've got in the Time Monster, this doctor who ends up being an assistant to the master while he's in disguise. And she just gets a couple of really great jabs at him for being, you know, patronizing, overbearing, condescending the entire time that they have to work together. So there's these one-off moments of greatness, but they're not really intentional about bringing in a lot of other women to interact with Joe on the show. So, you know, that was just sort of one episode where there were a few women for Joe to be talking with, but, you know, in terms of tests that we can use, you talk a lot about the length of time that people need to be talking or the screen time. And one of the things that always gets me about those tests is that it becomes very subjective, because you get a lot of media where maybe it's just one character, or it is a story that there's, you know, maybe one woman character and one male character, and so she doesn't ever have anyone else to talk to, so it's an automatic fail on the test. There's actually a test that was proposed after Pacific Rim came out called the Mako Mori test, which considers a movie a pass if there's at least one female character who gets her own narrative arc that is not about supporting a man's story. And it sort of attempts to address all the different ways in which the Bechdel test fails at measuring sort of the feminist quality of a piece of media without relying on screen time or any of those other measures that may address 80% of the films, but there's like 20% of films that wouldn't really show how feminist a media is just by the amount of time that a woman gets to speak on screen. And I like the test. I think it doesn't have quite the cultural awareness yet to be a very useful tool. So maybe it keeps getting out there and people keep talking about it and it becomes useful. But, you know, I think that there's plenty of media where there's one sole woman who is there that can still be valuable feminist media. But the Bechdel test is very good at showing industry-wide that we're not giving enough roles to women and that women aren't given roles besides the wife or the girlfriend or the lover. And that's where it's helpful.
Well, hopefully we're going to get a chance to discuss all these things further. Did you say that you had, when we were talking, we were actually tweeting a little bit earlier today, you said you had two panel topics that got approved for Galley?
Yeah, Feminism and the Companions and Wilderness Babies, about young fans who get into Classic Who. So I'm excited.
Not to be confused with Science Babies.
No, different babies. We're the weirder babies.
I don't know, science babies. Well, awesome. Well, we turned right around and made sure, because Haley and I will be there. Jay's not going to be able to attend because he's booked up all his vacation time for 2016. But we'll be there to represent for us. Are you going to turn right around and just say, yeah, I did submit those panels and I want to moderate those panels, and just send the email right back to them?
Pretty much. I'll just be like, yay, thank you for choosing them. Please, can I moderate? But, it should be fun no matter what. I'll be excited to see people talking about it anyway, but,
just heckle from the crowd.
Yeah.
Boom!
Just saying, I have like a whole list of notes about Feminism and Companions and how many times it's been explicitly mentioned. So just saying, right. I got that.
What about, speaking of cons, because I know this is something I've been dealing with both of these today. At the same time, they're reaching out for, they've done their, they've laid out their panel grid for Regeneration Who in Maryland for March. Are you going to be attending that one? That's relatively local for you, right?
Yeah, that's relatively local. I don't actually think I can go because of work things that will be happening at that time, and the fact that I may not be able to get the time off just because I have all of the things happening in April with family and work that I may need to take time off for. So unfortunately, it looks like all the other major Doctor Who conventions are just at incredibly inconvenient times for me. So I'm going to try to make time to get to something else other than Galley, but Galley is in my hometown, so I at least have a support base back there and everything to go to. And it happens to be the one weekend where I don't have any work obligations. So got to take advantage of that.
Damn straight.
Yep.
All right. Well, I will let you ladies both get back to all of your projects for the evening and all of your composition. I guess I'm going to have to start sound editing. So we will we'll bid adieu to all the folks who are still listening at this point after the credits. So, Clom bless you for listening for this long.
Conan does not pass the Bechdel test.
Yes, that is not even close. Not even Red Sonja passes the Bechdel test. And it was her damn movie.
Everything fails. You all fail.
F plus, 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 plus. All right, kids, go get some rest.
You too.
Thanks again, Alyssa.
No problem.
Bye.
Bye.